Hi, and welcome to the Vocal Fries podcast, the podcast about linguistic discrimination.
I'm Megan Figueroa.
And I'm Carrie Gillen.
I'm always so excited to be recording our intros and our interviews, and
this one's pretty fun. We talk all about young adult literature.
Yes.
And the South and Appalachia.
And let's just say that I fangirl a little bit. Let's just get that out of the way.
You definitely do. You definitely do. It's just fine.
You listen. I love young YA literature. My partner actually was a YA librarian for like 15 years.
Oh, that's right.
So there's that connection too. But the YA literature that's being written today, and the fact that, I mean, we have our guest on today because of like the goodness and richness in it, is just so good. So different than what I grew up with. So,
oh yeah, definitely. And we talk a little bit about how, like, the representation of Southerners is starting to change.
Yes.
But, yeah, it's a long time coming.
Absolutely. So I mentioned the documentary Hillbilly that I watched recently on Hulu, and just this quote that is that everyone basically has a Appalachia. So I think it's always important to come back to talking about the South, at least in the U.S., because it's so embedded in a lot of our heads that the South equals not as smart. And it's hard to move away from it. So it's always good to talk about it.
Yes. And it actually somewhat neatly maps onto other countries, too. There's almost always a region that has the same kind of associations with it. And that's not great. And we should all think about what we're doing when we're making these associations. So in Canada, I would say probably Newfoundland is the closest.
Yes. Which
analog.
Which episode? We have an episode on it. So if you haven't heard that, go back into the catalog. That was a fun conversation, too.
The rock was the rock before the rock by, I can't say by, the B-Y, B apostrophe Y thing. I can't do it. I'm not a Newfoundlander. Anyway, you can look that up, yes.
Ooh, let's talk about our favorite, or at least our namesake, disparaged quality.
Oh, right. Yes, nice. Nice segue.
You know, we're almost at 100 episodes. If I don't get the segues down at some point, I don't know what I'm doing here anymore.
So a few weeks ago, I started listening to the Murdoch Murders podcast. At the very end, I think even of the first episode, or maybe it's the second episode, but pretty early on, the host, Mandy Matney, says something about, you know, I'd love to hear your feedback, unless it's about my vocal fry.
Yes.
And I just started laughing because I was like, oh, I'm unsurprised that a woman podcaster is getting this feedback because, yeah.
Yeah, no, and I just started listening this last week and she made a good point of saying, why are you telling me this when I can't change it? And so, I mean, okay. I guess there, you know, if you really want to get rid of it, there are avenues to take, like, you know, speech language pathologists, there are some of them that could help you with that. But it's the idea that we keep telling women to stop using it when so many people use it. Most people use it at some point when they're, if they're speaking.
Most English speakers anyway. I'm not going to speak for other languages, but most English speakers for sure.
Yeah. That reminds me of the tweet by, Michael McCain? Is that McKean? Michael McKean?
McKean, yeah.
But what happened was Michael McKean basically disparaged Vocal Fry within his some other stuff. And then I tweeted from the Vocal Fries that he had I said hella Vocal Fry, just, you know, because might as well throw in the stereotypical Californian. although I do have hella in my...
I do too, so... Yeah. It actually fit our brand very well.
It was beautiful. So thanks for that, how do you call it, setup. I was going to say volley, Michael McKean. But yeah, no, it's people really, I don't know, there's no sort of self-reflection when it comes to vocal fry, I think. Hopefully we're changing that a bit when people catch us.
I literally thought, not even that long ago, like a month or two before that tweet, seems like no one cares about vocal... Actually, I know, sorry. I guess it was about a month or two before the Murdoch Murders podcast. I thought, oh, people don't seem to care about vocal fry anymore. It seems like that battle is over. Not necessarily people are okay with it, but just that they got bored. Kind of like how people have gotten bored of, like, shitting on Nickelback, right? It's too normie.
Sure, sure, sure.
Okay, yeah, we're bored. Yeah. That's what I thought. But no, it's still happening.
Yeah. Maybe people are being a bit quieter about it?
I think it's less. I do think people talk about it less. And I think that my instinct that people are kind of bored of it is actually true. It's just that that's not enough to stop it.
No. Right? Yeah, absolutely.
It has almost been 10 years.
Oh.
Right?
Yeah. Yeah.
Actually, it's been 10 years since that original study came out that, like, started this whole anti-vocal fry thing.
Is that when Ira Glass talked about it on This American Life?
I don't remember what year that was, but 2011 is when the study first came out, but I think people didn't start talking about it until 2012.
Okay. Yeah. January 2015 is when Ira talks about it on This American Life. I love that. I mean, we have it in our first episode, right?
We talk about it for sure, yeah. We always forget to mention that we have a Patreon, patreon.com/vocalfriespod, and we have a pretty awesome mug on there if you're interested.
Yeah.
But also stickers and bonus episodes.
Yes. Let me tease a little bit. The next bonus, probably December, is going to be a recording of us interviewing a special guest.
A literal celeb.
You will see the Zoom video that was recorded with their permission. I'm just gonna say. So yes, it's very exciting. You'll want to at least join for a month.
Yeah, and which is totally fine.
Right. I mean,
if you only have $5 just to access that for 1 month, you get the back catalog, so we'll get them all. That's fine. We totally understand.
Yes. Patreon.com/vocalfriespod.
So, one more thing before we switch.
Get to a great interview, by the way.
Yes, he's very charming. I definitely recommend listening. Yeah, so a few days ago now.
I think it's a week now.
Is it a week?
Yeah.
Oh, God. What is time?
I know.
Planet Word, the new DC museum about words, just asked for someone pretty terrible to talk about words. Actually, maybe I should just look up the tweet. Maybe that'd be easier.
So, at Planet Word DC tweeted on October 13th, "Do you ever struggle to find the right words? Join us on October 22nd to learn how to say what you mean with @WillIamJ as we discuss his new book, Wordwise, Say What You Mean, Deepen Your Connections, and Get to the Point."
So when I first saw that, I was like, Will I Am? Really?
I know. No, I did too. I was like, what?
Which would have been weird, but kind of cool. But no, this was just something else entirely.
Yeah. No, I think this man is playing off of Will I Am.
Yeah.
But no, not the same person, nor would I say probably has the same views on words. I'm guessing. I'm so upset. I expected more, you know?
Yeah, me too. I really expected more because I as someone else pointed out to me on Twitter, like, their whole idea was to push back against prescriptive ideas about words. So I did have the correct idea in my head that this was supposed to be a museum for the good and not a museum for shitting on language.
Yeah, and I'm upset in another way, too, since I'm someone who, as a linguist, cares about words and word learning and what words are. This is not, like, people confuse words with what it means to do language, and language is so much more than words, and the idea of saying what you mean is not just words and word choice, and also it's so, like, bound to culture and culture specific of, like, even your family or, like, your friend group of saying what you mean. It's different. It's not objective.
No. And even though I do like to find, like, the nicest possible word, the most specific possible word for certain things, not for speech so much, but, like, for my writing, I kind of appreciate the, like, intellectual exercise of that. But that's not even what he's doing.
No.
He's just saying these words are fundamentally bad because they don't I don't know, they don't do anything, he claims. But yes, all words do something.
Absolutely.
I mean, even these little words that we don't really think that much about, like so or whatever, they do something. And just because you're annoyed by it doesn't mean anything.
Yeah, absolutely. Good point. And when he says get to the point, I'm assuming he's going to shit on filler words. And like,
well, that's part of it. It's not all of it, though.
Right, right. But for him, I think I saw another linguist, like, saw an interview with him or took a screenshot from Google Books of the book, and it was, like, disparaging filler words. Like, get rid of your filler words. As if that's even possible all the time, by the way.
Yeah, it's, you can probably learn to get rid of some, of, like, a lot of them, but why?
But at what cost,
like, in
Carrie?
Some cases, fine. Like, and if you hear a lot of them in a row, it does get a little bit tedious, I guess. But, like, most filler words are not even that. They actually have information. And have the information of, oh, I'm searching for a word, please don't interrupt me.
Right.
But there are other filler words that have more information than that, even. Like.
Mm-hmm. Right? Yes. Which, another callback, listen to our episode.
Yes! So he does shit on filler words, but that's not even all he does. Like, he says you shouldn't use the word always unless you literally mean always
in every instance,
etc. You know, like, right? Like, all of these things, it's all filled with all this ideology about language and
absolutely
communication and why, planet word? Why?
I know, it's really disappointing. And guess what? It ultimately ends up being certainly misogynistic, as the examples we talked about. I'm sure racist. But it's like filler words, just like you said, we use them so we can keep the floor so people don't interrupt us. Well, guess what? Women get interrupted all the time, and there are so many strategies that we have to use to prevent that from happening. So it's I have a feeling his talk is basically going to be like, don't use language like women have been socially forced to do, or
yeah, it's definitely sexist and classist and all kinds of stuff.
Yeah.
So here's another example: amazing and awesome. Amazing is one of the phony positives that has proven to turn friends and customers off because we feel the phony.
What?
No.
I say things are amazing and I mean it.
I mean, if a corporation uses these words, I might get turned off because I think that they're phony. But that's because they're a corporation. It's not the word choice,
right.
Or, like, it's not alone. It's not the word choice alone.
Right.
Yeah, so he's just...
Yeah, not cool.
Not great. Not a great choice. Linguists are pissed.
There's so many linguists, or even non-linguists, that have written books about words and stuff. Like... Corey Stamper, lexicographer. There's so many people that they could have asked to do something like this.
Yeah, look at our back catalog and ask almost anyone else.
Yeah. Invite poets. Like our guest, even, you know, like, think outside of the box. Don't think of the most obvious, stereotypical, gross thing that people associate with words.
Anyone who calls anything word trash is probably a bad idea. Yeah. I'm so sad. I am so disappointed. I am heartbroken because this seemed like such a cool idea. I was excited that maybe one day I would get to visit. And now I don't feel like I want to. I mean, things could change. I'm not saying I'm canceling them forever or whatever. But, like, right now, no.
Yeah, look what you did.
No interest.
What you did, Planet Word. You're making Carrie just, like, completely not want to ever come back to the U.S. That's what you did.
Well, I didn't say that. And there are other reasons to be avoiding the U.S.
Or
right
always.
Now. Well, the case of the numbers are finally going
yes,
down.
Yes, yes, yes. Anyway. Well, yeah. So, I guess the moral of our intro here is, again, don't be an asshole. Don't be a prescriptive asshole.
Yes. Stop being an asshole about language, people. Like this show and want to make your own? Let me tell you about Anchor. It's free.
And they have creation tools that allow you to record and edit your podcast right from your phone or computer. And now you can even add any song from Spotify directly to your episodes. The possibilities are endless for what you can create, whether it's music analysis, your own radio show, or something the world's never heard before. Anchor will distribute your podcast for you so it can be heard on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and many more. And you can also make money from your podcast with no minimum listenership. It's everything you need to make a podcast in one place. So download the free Anchor app or go to anchor.fm to get started.
Okay, so I'm really excited to say that we have Jeff Settner here. He is the author of the New York Times notable book, The Serpent King, which is literally my favorite YA book, so I'm very excited. Not only that, Goodbye Days, Rain and Delilah's Midnight Matinee, and most recently, In the Wild Light. He has won the William C. Morris Award, the Amelia Elizabeth Walden Award, the International Literacy Association Award, and the Westchester Fiction Award. He was selected as a Publisher's Weekly Flying Start and an Indies Introduce pick. His books have been translated into 15 languages. And before becoming a writer, he was a musician who recorded with Iggy Pop, Nick Cave, and Debbie Harry. We are so excited to have you here, Jeff. Thank you for being here.
Yeah, thanks for coming.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, so I have been reading your latest, In the Wild Light, and I got to this part in the book, and I just like... got up from my bed and just like wrote a note to myself to just contact you in case you might be interested in coming on, because you write so beautifully the dialogue in a Southern variety. But before we get to that, I want to know a little bit about your language history, just for context. You write about rural Tennessee. Is that where you're from?
Well, no, I actually grew up in rural Kansas. That's where I lived about the first 15 years of my life, although I have lived now between Tennessee and Western North Carolina for most of my life. It is certainly the place that I chose for myself. It's the place that feels like home to me now more than any other. So it's kind of one of those weird things where I didn't actually grow up here, but I consider myself from here. I consider myself to be of this place.
And then, so do you now consider yourself Appalachian or Southern?
I definitely consider myself Southern. I have lived in Appalachia. I consider myself Appalachian enough, I guess you'd say, in terms of my love for the culture, my love for Appalachian people. I live currently in Nashville, which I do consider to be kind of the cultural capital of Appalachia, or at least a cultural capital of Appalachia. It's certainly where the music of Appalachia came to be disseminated to the wider world, and it gained a certain cachet and prominence here. And still Nashville, I think, is an important capital of Appalachia. So yeah, I would consider myself Appalachian.
What was it like growing up in Kansas?
It was a lot like living here in the South. I mean, one thing about living in this modern age is that it's flattened out the experience a lot. There are fewer regional differences, where back in, you know, the 1920s and 30s, you'd get these music forms that only existed in certain regions and maybe didn't get disseminated widely until they were on the radio. Now with the internet, kids in Appalachia, they're not sitting around listening to banjo and fiddle tunes. They're listening to, you know, Lil Wayne and Taylor Swift and Kanye West and Post Malone, and along with country music, to be sure. But growing up in rural Kansas was very, very much like growing up in the rural South, which is why I think, and I've been told that I write the experience of growing up and coming of age in the rural South with accuracy.
It's striking to me because it also sounds like the experiences of my friends who grew up in rural Arizona. So it makes me feel like there's this something about growing up in rural places that connects people from rural places. Certainly regional differences, but I wonder if you get that impression.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think that even extends, being that we're on a language podcast, I think that even extends to the way people speak, even the accents. If you listen to somebody from rural Kansas talk, they're going to sound like somebody from Alabama. There has become an American rural accent almost. If you hear somebody talk from rural Arizona, they will have that American rural accent. They'll sound like they're from rural Kansas, or they'll sound like they're from the rural South. Now, I think that does change somewhat depending on some areas. For example, if you get into the upper Midwest and you get to like rural Wisconsin, I think there's a very distinctive rural upper Midwest accent and things like that. But yeah, I think there is a sort of commonality of experience throughout rural America. There are certain businesses that are drawn to rural America. You see the Dollar Generals all over the South. You see the Family Dollars. You see your Cracker Barrels in rural places. You know, you see your Walmarts in rural places. So again, there's kind of that flattening out of experience where I think somebody who grew up in a small town in Arizona is probably going to have a lot more in common with somebody who grew up in a small town in Alabama than with somebody who grew up in Phoenix, you know, 2 hours away.
Oh, absolutely. So the idea that 45 minutes, you know, south or north or whatever, you could be in a bigger place, I think is also speaks to this experience, because it's like some of these people have never actually been 45 minutes north or south or wherever. I'm thinking just of your book, In the Wild Light, too, that you can really feel like an outsider pretty quickly. Do you feel that that's true?
I certainly feel like it's true for me. It doesn't take much for me to feel like an outsider. I've kind of felt like an outsider all my life to whatever community I've been in. I've been in religious communities where I felt like an outsider because I didn't entirely buy into all the beliefs or teachings of that religion. I've felt like an outsider as a writer because I'm new to writing. I don't have a degree in writing. I've never had any training in writing. So I feel sometimes like an outsider in that community. As a musician, I felt like an outsider in that community because I came to music relatively late. I started playing guitar when I was around 19, which is kind of late to get started. But so yeah, I do think there's that element of outsidership.
I then wonder, what would you say is the difference between the varieties of language you can find in Nashville versus Eastern Tennessee or Western North Carolina?
Well, there is a very distinctive Southern Appalachian accent that is different from just a run-of-the-mill Southern accent. And in The Wild Light, I highlighted one kind of specific, I guess, linguistic feature of Appalachian pronunciation, which is the UP sound up will get pronounced as ep thar. And they'll, so up there becomes ep thar. And that's how it's, and it's a pronunciation, I believe, that resembles this. This is so fascinating to me. I love the development of accents. I love learning things like that Elizabethan English was probably pronounced closer to an American Southern accent than to the present day British accent, which is something I've heard.
You're in the right place right now.
Good, good. I'm glad. Love to geek out about this stuff. But yeah, there are certain quirks of Appalachian pronunciation that I believe I've read, and this may be true, it may not. I'm again not a trained linguist, but are holdovers from when you had isolated communities of Scotch Irish living in the mountains of Southern Appalachia, from the Scottish Highlands, from Ireland, you know, from poorer parts of England, because that's who was coming over to America, and that's who was being forced to settle on this very kind of non-arable. Is arable the word for when you can grow things?
Yes, that's correct.
Okay, there we go. For this non-arable land in the Southern Mountains, that's who was kind of being forced to the Southern Mountains. So you see this sort of distinctive pronunciation, and that's something I tried to highlight in one of the scenes of the book and through kind of a running thread of the book where Cash is, my main character is named Cash Pruitt, where his wealthy roommate from Scottsdale, Arizona, which is just right outside of Phoenix,
Oh no, you got him right. You wrote him correctly.
is Megan, is that where you're from? Is the Phoenix area?
The Phoenix area.
Okay.
Yeah.
Okay.
Not from Scottsdale.
No, the other side of Phoenix.
Yeah.
Well, one of my YA writer friends, Stephanie Perkins, who now hilariously lives in Western North Carolina in Asheville. She grew up in Phoenix, which is so bizarre to me. She's so not a Phoenix person, but I asked her, I need to write the most awful character on earth. I want to have him be from Phoenix because Phoenix just seems like this huge, dry, sprawling metropolis. I want him to be from Phoenix. Yeah. What's the worst part of Phoenix for him to be from? And without even thinking, she immediately goes, Scottsdale. Like, didn't even have it out of my
mind. I love it.
If we're going to send him somewhere, it should be the most horrible, most miserable place on earth.
Scottsdale.
Yeah, so Trip is written perfectly as someone from Scottsdale who is wealthy and has a high-ranking father. Yeah.
And I'm so sorry if you're a wealthy person from Scottsdale who loves golfing and also loves linguistic podcasts. I hope I'm
not
offending
listening.
You, but...
there's maybe one person.
One.
There's always that one person who doesn't fit what they grew up as.
Right. Right.
So anyway, this roommate Trip from Scottsdale, he makes fun of the way that that my main character's grandfather, his papaw, which is another little that's what Appalachian people call their grandparents, papaw and mamaw, how he speaks and how specifically how he pronounces up there as et thar.
Yeah, that's the scene that I contacted you after I read. I'm gonna read you to you. What's it you called him? I don't want to say it, but I do to keep the peace. Papaw. Papaw? He snickers. It's an East Tennessee thing. I should have waited until I found my headphones. You must because he takes the call, FaceTime call without his headphones. You must have gotten a fire-ass scholarship because we sound unsophisticated and hillbilly, is what Cash is thinking. And so I noted that, and I was like, oh my god, not only are you writing Papaw's dialogue, or Papaw's, accent, like, so beautifully. But this scene, I think, is so perfect because, one, just thinking about being YA, it's so nice to know that some people that are coming of age will see this. And I wonder what you think about that, and, like, specifically writing for people that are coming of the age in the South and actually getting to see this representation.
Well, so Southern Appalachian kids have a pretty rough go of things in a lot of ways, one of which being that they're a pretty easy butt of jokes in our pop culture. It's still considered pretty okay to joke about kids who live in rural areas like Appalachia, depressed areas like Appalachia, as, you know, snaggletooth rednecks, bumpkins, you know, white trash, which is a term I particularly hate. Because there's a lot of collateral damage to that term. I mean, not only are you mocking economically depressed white people, but with that term, you're setting up the implicit premise that the default is trash, right? And then you have to specify white trash. So it's just a tremendously offensive term that really rarely gets called out, which I find shocking because everybody should be offended by it. But they've got a rough go. They're the butt of jokes in pop culture. They live in a region that's been traditionally exploited by moneyed interests, whether it be coal mines, mining. Now it's really the pharmaceutical industry, kind of promoting these pain killing drugs, these pain killing opioids. Making a concerted effort to sell these in these areas, getting them hooked on drugs. And so they've had to deal with a lot of exploitation. They've had to deal with a lot of, economic, currents that produce bad living situations. So they're just not afforded, I think, a lot of dignity in pop culture. And that's what I hoped to do with this book. I hoped some of these kids would be able to see themselves in this book, to see the beauty and the richness of their culture and their land. That's why I have Cash in the book be a nature lover, because truly the natural beauty of Appalachia is, it's stunning. It's like nothing else. It's absolutely gorgeous.
It really is. I've only been to Nashville, but, you know, oh my God, it's so beautiful.
It's truly spectacular. I mean, if you ever get a chance, go visit East Tennessee and Western North Carolina. You'll see why the Highland Scots settled there, because it does look like the Scottish Highlands, these gorgeous, oh, wow, rolling, misty mountains that fade into the horizon in these kind of shades of blue and purple and violet, and just as stunning as can be. So I hoped to show them to be proud of that part of their experience, to be proud of the tradition of family and storytelling and poetry that is kind of part of their heritage, part of their birthright. And just to show a couple of Appalachian kids who have dignity, who are smart, who are brilliant kids, who have dreams and hopes and goals and loves. And I think all of that is really important for kids to see.
I agree. You also use the word hillbilly. What do you think about that word?
I mean, I think it's one of those words that if people against whom the word is directed want to reclaim it and use it for themselves, which I hear sometimes, that's fine. But I don't think it's a word that should be imposed upon them by outsiders. I think if they want to reclaim it, and many of my friends who live in the hills, who live in Appalachia, have reclaimed it for themselves, then I think that's perfectly valid. There's a really interesting history behind the term redneck that is not what you would imagine. A lot of people think it comes from, you know, just rural Southern white people working in the fields, getting sunburned, you know, and that's why they call them rednecks. There is a very complicated history that involves the labor movement, that involves the socialism movement. I will butcher it if I try to recite this history, but my friend Rob Boken wrote a fantastic piece for the online magazine Wrath-Bearing Tree for Labor Day about this term redneck. So Google Rob Boken, R-O-B-B-O-K-K-O-N, and redneck, and I think it'll come up, this piece he wrote. But he's a fantastic historian, and he goes into the history of this term redneck. It came from red scarves that these striking workers would wear, and they came to be known as rednecks because of that. Now it's become essentially a class-based slur, but it once had kind of this proud provenance.
Oh yeah, shocking that something that would be used, you know, positively for socialists would be get turned into something negative.
I know. Imagine that. Who could have envisioned such a thing happening?
You have you ever been judged for the variety that you speak?
No, I haven't. I've always had a very flat accent. I've always had the opportunity, had opportunities for education, and I came from a really solidly middle class home of the kind that's disappearing now, where a father could work a job that didn't pay an exorbitant amount whatsoever. My dad was a college professor for a lot of the time I was growing up, was a pharmaceutical researcher, and they don't make tons of money, but it was enough for a middle-class existence. I went to good public schools in a college town. So I had a lot of opportunities for education that certainly gave me the opportunity to learn and to, I guess, have the chance to avoid situations that would normally lead to ridicule.
You've been blurbed by Silas House, who I've quoted. I've like even asked Carrie back for the regionalism chapter in our book that we're writing, so I could add more Silas House to it. you know him, right?
I do. In fact, we're going to be doing an event together up in Bowling Green, Kentucky, next month.
Did you watch the Hillbilly documentary?
I have not seen it yet, although I need to.
He plays prominently in it, and he mentions that he was once asked if he knew who Johnny Carson was, because when he was outside of the South, outside of Appalachia, because the woman assumed that they didn't have TVs in Appalachia.
Well, Johnny Carson, at this point, I would be like, do people remember who he is? I guess this was a while ago.
It was a while ago, yeah.
What's so funny about that is I was introduced to one of my favorite comedy sketch shows, Tim and Eric Awesome Show, Great Job, which if you've never heard of that, it's just going to prove my point even more strongly. It's this comedy show, really highly kind of experimental, sort of anti-comedy, very, very kind of cutting edge comedy, very daring, very edgy comedy. And the first time I ever saw it in my life was visiting my friend Josie up in Louisa, Kentucky, which is a town of, I think, maybe 1,500 on the Eastern Kentucky, West Virginia border, because they've got satellites now. They've got satellite dishes. They have access. They have internet. They have broadband sometimes. So they have access to these things. So I just thought that was really funny that here I lived in Nashville, this kind of entertainment center, this very metropolitan, cosmopolitan place. And I drive up to Louisa, Kentucky to visit for the weekend. And I get introduced to this very highly experimental comedy. I thought that was a real subversion of what you usually think of as being the cultural exchange.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. On the podcast, I like to point out instances of linguistic discrimination that I may have participated in, because we're all growing. And, you know, if we're from the U.S., we all, you know, depending on our age, grew up with certain media. And even though I had family from Oklahoma, I certainly bought into the idea that the South was all Beverly Hillbillies, because I stayed up late and watched Nick at Night, and that just seemed like, okay, why would the TV lie to me? I realized later it would lie to me all the time, and it still does. But
yeah, and as a Canadian, I got the same media, so I had a very similar experience, although I didn't have any family. I'm now married to a Southerner, but I didn't have any family at the time. So
what's funny about Canada is there's, I think, this whole generation, and I think it's my generation, that kind of accidentally grew up on Canadian TV, and we didn't even realize it because Nickelodeon showed so many Canadian TV shows.
Yeah.
So we grew up on, like, you can't do that on television. Yes. this bizarre comedic sensibility, and all these people saying sorry and a boot. And, you know, growing up with Dave Coulier. And so I've got this weird streak of Canadian pop culture in my cultural DNA. It's very strange.
I know.
Megan, speaking of Oklahoma and linguistic quirks and TV, I can't help but think of the show Reservation Dogs that I've become completely addicted to.
Yes.
I have to throw it a plug on this show because it's just fantastic. It takes place on a Native American reservation in Oklahoma, and it strikes me as very authentic. I mean, it's made by a Native American creator, all Native actors, and it has a lot of what I think are probably accurate linguistic quirks of the area, and just a fascinating, beautiful, heartfelt show.
I will have to watch it. It's on my list of to-dos.
Yeah, I've been watching it. I'm behind, but I've been watching it. And yeah, no, it's really good. And one of the characters said Sonics, which apparently is a pan Native American thing to call Sonics. And
Sonics?
Yeah, stuff like that. Yeah,
I love stuff like that. Love it.
Oh, yeah, we did one episode with a friend on Res English, and in it is always something that sticks out to me. Was that in the show at all? Carrie, do you recognize in it?
I don't think so, but it might not be the right region. I don't know.
Innit, like the way the British say in it?
Yeah.
Huh, wow, I haven't heard that, but...
So if you watch Smoke Signals, they use innit in that a lot, but they're also from the Pacific Northwest, which is where my friend Peter Jacobs is also from. So, like, it does come more down the west, I think, rather than in the east.
Okay, a western thing. Yeah, I think the Dene use it.
Yeah, too. I think it's all the way down. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah, no, there's these interesting, I mean, it's so beautiful, and I invited you here just to compliment you, apparently.
I'll take it.
I love how you write about language and words in this one specifically, because, you know, Cash is in a poetry class and I know you're a poet. So I love you. I love how you sneak in poems to your books. But I love linguistic quirks that kind of mark you know, maybe identity or region or whatever. I think it's beautiful, and I think it's a shame that so many people use it to discriminate against people.
Yeah, nothing is more heartbreaking to me than when somebody gets made fun of for the way they talk. I mean, that is so, it's so fundamental. You have so little choice over it. You know, it's so unconscious. Absolutely heartbreaking to me. Heartbreaking to me that somebody would get made fun of for what they call their grandfather, you know? This term of endearment. One thing I wanted to set up with that dynamic between Trip and Cash, Trip from Scottsdale, wealthy, is that even people who would identify with a political persuasion that would label, you know, some parts of America the real America, like rural parts of America, that's the real America. And I think Tripp certainly would identify with politicians who said things like that and who did that. Even people like that, and sometimes especially people like that, discriminate against rural Americans and mock rural Americans.
Oh, yeah.
Because it's fake. They don't believe
exactly
what they're saying.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It's they're speaking in code.
They're speaking definitely in code. Yeah. Yes. Yes, definitely. So maybe you don't want to talk about inauthentic portrayals, but maybe you do. Do you have any inauthentic portrayals of Southern / Appalachian language?
Oh gosh, yeah. Of fakes. Well, a terrible Southern accent will make a show immediately unwatchable to me. I just can't do it.
Like The Walking Dead?
Yes, absolutely. The Walking Dead. True Blood was a particularly awful offender in this regard. Oh gosh, I'm trying to think of some other ones.
Wait, let me just say, please, be kind if you're going to say that Timothy Oliphant did a poor job in Justified, because he is so handsome.
And you can't say anything bad about handsome men, I guess.
I'll say this. Timothy Oliphant's accent isn't great. No. But he is so charismatic and fun to watch on screen. And he's got such a mischievous little glint in his little eye. I love Timothy Oliphant, so I give him a pass. His Southern accent is not terrific, but I gotta give him a pass on it.
Yeah.
What's funny though in Justified is that Walton Goggins doesn't have a particularly great Southern accent. Oh. He grew up in Atlanta.
Yeah.
Which is so funny to me.
I wonder if it's because he was trying to do, like, the Appalachian, like whatever he perceives as Appalachian, instead of his own.
It's Kentucky, right?
No, was it in Kentucky? I thought it was.
Yeah, it's okay. Eastern Kentucky. I think Hazard, Kentucky, which is in Eastern Kentucky. I've heard him in other things, though, where he wasn't playing Appalachian, and it's similarly not a great Southern accent. Again, so funny, because he did grow up in Atlanta, apparently grew up in Georgia. Now, a show with really, really good Southern accents is Rectify, which is on Netflix. It was a Sundance show.
Yes.
Just a gorgeous show.
Yes.
Man,
it's
really,
so good.
Really well done. It's so good.
And the main guy's Canadian. And I've also seen him in an Australian show doing an Australian accent, which I can't judge, but seemed good.
Seemed good, yeah.
I wonder if he has an ear for it, like a particular talent.
Some people do,
yeah,
but that one is phenomenal. Friday Night Lights is generally pretty good on the Texas accents. The Texas accent is pretty indistinguishable from a Southern accent to most ears, certainly to my ear. So that one did things well, but yeah, I'll tell you the biggest problem with the fake Southern accent is. They think that Southerners pronounce the word "your" as "yo." Well, now you're gonna get your fill of this if you listen too long. And that's not how Southerners pronounce the word "your." They pronounce it "your." You're gonna get your fill. You're gonna get your, you know. So they don't say "yo" for "your." That's one of the biggest markers I see that that people aren't getting it right.
You want to know why that is?
Why is that?
Because they're aiming for an old Southern accent.
Ah, yeah. Mm. I think that could be. I think that could be.
Because it used to be the white Southerners used to not have R's in that position. And then they started using R's in that position, like around World War II. So, yeah.
Oh, wow. That's fascinating.
Is that why Daniel Craig in Knives Out was...
Oh, there we go. The quintessential horrible Southern accent.
I'm pretty sure that was on purpose, that he purposely used an old Southern accent as his target. And like, so I think he's supposed to be bad, but maybe I'm giving him too much credit. I don't know.
Another thing that actors miss with the Southern accent is that the double E is an A sound. So, you know, we're going to the meeting. We're going to the mating. So it's an A sound instead of a double E sound. That's another thing they get wrong.
Do you have in mind any dialogue written in books that has been particularly offensive?
Yeah. Where the Crawdads Sing was unreadable to me because it is. And listen, people love that book. Lord knows. I mean, I think it sold like 50 million copies or something. I found it unreadable. I find written dialect to be so exhausting to read. And the problem with it is that if you're going to have a certain way of hearing the words on the page. And if you impose a reading on the page that interrupts the way that you would normally naturally hear the words, it's very jarring to me. So I know how people in North Carolina talk. I know I can hear them naturally. If you just put the words on the page, I'll know how the words are being pronounced. But when you put them on the page with this heavy, heavy dialect, I find it really difficult to read, really tiresome. It's why I don't write in dialect. Even when I'm trying to convey a Southern accent, I give you the fact that these characters are from the rural South. You're going to have to meet me halfway because I'm not going to try to give you those pronunciations in dialect. It's just, it borders on offensive too, I think.
With Papaw, there is like distinct parts of his language variety in the dialect that you've written, but I guess it's the words and not like you trying to get someone to think of how...
It's not the eye dialect.
The vowel sound. Yeah.
Yeah. You get people to hear the musicality of the accent. You get people to hear the language through your word choice and the way you construct the sentences, the colloquialisms you use.
What really struck out or stood out for me was the double negatives, because people just disparage the use of double negatives. And both of my parents have double negatives. And I got rid of mine because that's how I felt that I needed to do to succeed in the world.
I mean, my parents didn't have it, but I still got it because it's actually, I think, very logical. And so, but I also got rid of it when I was like 10 or something because my parents told me it was wrong.
Yeah, no, and certainly people in the South are told in so many different ways that X is wrong. And so I wonder if you're thinking about that when you're writing, for example, Papaw's dialogue.
Yeah, I'm absolutely thinking about the way that rural Southerners construct sentences. I'm thinking of their colloquialisms they use, right down to little things like Southerners say, do what for what? So if you say something and I don't hear you, do what? Do what now?
That's funny. I didn't know that. Because, you know, do you watch Bob's Burgers? I know Carrie does. The character of Zeke says, do what?
Oh, okay. Yeah, that's a Southernism. I wouldn't be surprised if a Southerner wrote that character. So there's that. There's getting your picture made is instead of getting your picture taken, we're going to get our pictures made. Where you put the emphasis on some words like umbrella, they say umbrella. They say buffet instead of buffet. I'm trying to think of some other ones.
Insurance.
That's one. So, with Papaw, I definitely use the double negative because that's a common feature of Appalachian speech. I'm kind of looking through the book now to see what other things I did. I just kind of do it instinctively. If you want to see a really, really keen ear for Appalachian colloquial dialogue, read the book Child of God by Cormac McCarthy. He's got just an unbelievable ear for Appalachianisms and the color of local dialogue. It's really wonderful.
Is that person from the area, or
he was born and raised in East Tennessee. Now he kind of famously lives in the West and writes books set in the West. But yeah, his formative years were in East Tennessee, so he really grew up with those linguistic speech patterns as part of his life.
Well, how about Kansas dialect? We've never really talked about the Kansas dialect. Is there anything that makes it distinctive from other varieties?
Not really. Sometimes you'll get an R in a word like wash, so you get warsh.
Oh, that's, yeah, okay. In Washington State, sometimes in the rural areas, you'll hear that too.
Yeah, yeah. So you get an R in warsh. Other than that, it's largely Southern. I mean, people say y'all, and nothing terribly, terribly interesting. And outside of the rural areas, the Kansas accent is very just flat Midwestern, you know, newscastery.
Yeah, I was recently in rural Missouri, and most of the students were from St. Louis, but I was talking to some students and asked how they felt about Midwestern, the quote-unquote Midwestern accent being like the go-to, or at least described as the go-to of how you need to sound to be successful. Because actually someone in Hillbilly says that she feels like she has to code switch from Appalachian English to Midwestern or Californian English. So the people in the class just didn't even occur to them that their, you know, accent that they may hear around them in the Midwest would be something to aim for. But I wonder if there was any sort of that, like, message that you, so at 15, now in Tennessee, heard, like, you need to sound like X to be successful.
Nobody delivered that message explicitly, but culture delivers that message by every time they need to show somebody slow-witted, they give them a Southern accent. Every time. I mean, a thick, heavy Southern accent. So the message isn't always delivered explicitly, like, you need to talk this way to be successful or to be thought intelligent. But pop culture makes sure you get the message.
I do think this is finally starting to change because, you know, for example, there's a woman from, I believe, South Carolina, apparently from the region that my husband is from, is in For All Mankind, and she's playing a character with that same accent. Like, she's not changing her accent. That's her accent. And she's working for NASA. Like, so it feels like finally they were starting to, like, chip away a little bit at this.
Yeah.
Like, just.
Yep.
I hate it so much. I hate like so many, like The Simpsons and so many things. It's just, yeah, yep. I use yokels.
Yeah. Thinking of this specifically, how it's not always explicit. In your book, I really, really loved, it just gave me the feels that you noticed this change in Cash where, I don't know if it's a change, but he feels comfortable enough to start saying Papaw to his group of friends. And then his poetry instructor. And I think that that's really, I don't know if it's subtle to some people or not, or if it's more overt, but it's like a really nice transition to kind of think about how, like, he's letting his true self be known. And that includes, you know, these words from Eastern Tennessee, these things from Eastern Tennessee, like words and his dialect and all that.
Yeah, so what I think is the driving force behind that is that he does meet this poetry instructor, Dr. Adkins, Brittany Ray Adkins, who, when he's discovering that she's also from Appalachia, she goes, "My name is Brittany Ray Adkins. Does that sound like I was born in New York City?"
Yeah.
And he kind of blushes. He's like, "Yeah, I guess not."
Right.
But he discovers that this incredibly brilliant poetry instructor is from his cultural region, is from Eastern Kentucky, a few hours away from where he grew up. And she's got a PhD. She teaches poetry. She's a National Book Award finalist, in demand from these elite schools. And she says to him at once that she called her Papaw, Papaw. And so it makes him feel like it's not a thing for stupid people. It's not a thing for unsophisticated people.
Yeah, and her poetry book is called Holler, which I think is fantastic. Again, it's like, unfortunately, we associate Appalachia or the South with unsophisticated from media portrayals and all of this. So the idea that the word holler would be on a poetry award winning or, you know, award winning poetry book is fantastic.
Sure, sure. And for those of your listeners who don't know, a holler is an Appalachianism for a hollow, a small, you know, a little valley in the mountains. And that there are a lot of hollers in Appalachia. Hills and hollers.
And we have a whole episode about that with Paul Reed.
Oh, cool.
Yeah. We have a linguist who's Appalachian who came on. And he's the reason why I know how to say Appalachian instead of Appalachian.
Same.
Oh, yeah. So I make sure and take that on in the wildlife as well. That's how Cash knows that Dr. Adkins is really from Appalachia.
Yeah, it's like a shibboleth, right?
Exactly.
You say on your website that you wanted to write for, you know, why young adults particularly. And I think it's so important that, I mean, they get the message that they are good and valued and their language is valid from the very beginning. But I think it's great to see YA books that are portraying it as such. So I wonder what you want to see more of in YA books or in contemporary fiction or just in the book world in general, or maybe even, you know, for different types of media when it comes to the portrayal of the South in Appalachia.
So two of my favorite texts on the rural South are Salvage the Bones by Jesmond Ward, which is rural Black people in Mississippi, and Now Reservation Dogs, which is rural indigenous people in Oklahoma. I think more stories of rural people of color are needed. I mean, just in general, more stories of rural people, but definitely within that underrepresented subset of stories about rural people of color. I want to see stories of rural Latino people in the South. North Carolina, I think, has the quickest growing Latino population in America, over Arizona, over Texas, over New Mexico. I think Tennessee is like top 10 as well. And so you go out to these rural towns now in North Carolina and Tennessee, and you see like carnicerias and paderias and these like Mexican groceries and Central American groceries. And so there's this whole Latino community. I don't want to read that experience. There's a really specific experience that I am bonkers to read. I want to read a book about this so badly. I did a school visit in southern Texas, rural Texas, right along the border. And I found out that there were kids at that high school every day crossed the border from Mexico into the United States to attend high school and then went back to Mexico. I want so badly for somebody to write a book about the experience of getting up and going to school every day in the richest country in the world and going back home. To me, that is absolutely fascinating.
I agree. I mean, that happens in Arizona too. Obviously, yeah. They cross the border every morning. And I even mentored a student last year that came he had that experience. And it was like nothing to him. Like, he said it casually. And I'm just like, oh, wow.
Somebody please write that book, please.
You know, this is like not at all the same, but there are kids in Point Roberts, Washington State, who have to drive through Canada back to the United States to go to high school.
That's wild. An international journey every day to go to high school is bonkers to me.
It totally, yeah, absolutely.
I don't know what they're doing now. I mean, maybe it's still happening, but the border is sort of closed. Although Americans can come if they're vaccinated now, so maybe it's all, I don't know. Anyway, bizarre.
Yeah.
The world is bizarre.
It is. So beyond just media, how can we be kinder to each other about our differences in language?
Well, I think there's a real opportunity there to see the beauty of the way other people speak and to partake of that. The same way we have the opportunity when we eat at a restaurant that serves some cuisine we're not used to, when we go to a Thai restaurant, when we go to an Indian restaurant, we have the opportunity to experience something different than we were raised with, different than we're used to, and to enjoy the beauty of it. And the same way that we let the flavors of that cuisine, you know, spread across our tongues and please that pleasure, that taste pleasure center of our brain, I think we have to approach language with that same way, that we're going to let all language land upon our tongue with that same searching of joy and deliciousness. I lived in Brazil for a while and became fluent in Portuguese. So I speak fluent Portuguese, and to learn another language, it's so wonderful and exciting. And I hope that we can start to see language as exciting in that way and delicious in that way, in a way that we can experience the world and expand ourselves by meeting people on their own terms linguistically. Well, this was a real honor. Thank you for having me on your show.
Thank you.
Thank you. And we always leave our listeners with one final message.
Don't be an asshole.
Succinct, to the point, and yes. So important.
And this month, we would like to thank our latest patron, Karen Jaffe.
Karen, thank you so much. We really appreciate you.
Yes. And as a reminder, if anyone wants to join, we have $2, $3, $5, and $15 support levels. And you get all kinds of things like stickers or bonus episodes or, as we said before, the mug.
Yeah.
The Vocal Fries podcast is produced by me, Carrie Gillen, for Halftone Audio. Theme music by Nick Granum. You can find us on Tumblr, Twitter, Facebook, and Instagram at Vocal Fries Pod. You can email us at vocalfriespod@gmail.com, and our website is vocalfriespod.com.